Welcome to Royally Screwed. My name is Chris Shearer, and it's my honor to take you on a tour through some of history's greatest, worst, and bizarre rulers. Hey, you guys know about pyramids? Square bottom, four triangular sides? Those are cool, right? And of course, if you think about pyramids, you probably think of Egypt. And the pyramids of Egypt are the three found in the Giza Pyramid Complex. Egyptian pyramids are, for the most part, tombs for pharaohs. But who were the pharaohs who those famous pyramids were built for? Okay, I'm gonna be honest, this episode is definitely gonna skew more about talking about pyramids than it will talking about those pharaohs because, well, we don't know much about them. So if you're here to learn about people and not architecture, this probably isn't the episode for you. I fully understand that. But anyways, who actually are the pharaohs those pyramids were built for? That would be the pharaohs Khufu, Khafre, and Menkaure. These three rulers of ancient Egypt reigned during the 4th dynasty, a proclaimed golden age for the Old Kingdom of Egypt. That's quite a few things we're gonna have to talk about besides the pyramids. However, the 4th dynasty was also the height of the pyramid era, so that'll lead back into my geometric designs anyways. However, the period of the 4th dynasty also marked a major change in how pharaohs worked within the grand scheme of Egypt and its religion. This means we also get to talk about the Egypt concept of the afterlife. There is something here for everyone. So, without further ado, let's begin the story. We're going back in time to the 4th dynasty of ancient Egypt in the mid-3rd millennium BCE in the Pyramid Scheme. I've jumped around a lot in Egyptian history throughout this podcast, but we've mostly stuck to the latter half of Pharaonic Egypt. I did, however, do an episode over the guy we think was the first pharaoh, Narmer, that being way back in episode 6. Narmer's rule started the Old Kingdom in ancient Egypt, so let's learn a bit about what the rest of the Old Kingdom was like from the first up to the beginning of the 4th dynasty. The first and second dynasties of Egypt make up the Archaic period. The first dynasty was founded sometime around 3100 BCE, give or take a century, by a pharaoh named Narmer when he united Upper and Lower Egypt. Those two regions are named after their position on the Nile River, which, unlike most other major rivers of the world, flows south to north. So Upper Egypt is actually southern Egypt, and Lower Egypt is in the north. We have a few artifacts that have survived from around this time to corroborate historical accounts, and we believe we found tombs of most, if not all, of these pharaohs. They were mostly buried in small structures we now call by their Arabic name, mastabas. These were rectangular buildings made of mud brick, which is exactly what it sounds like. The actual sarcophagus for some of these pharaohs may have also been placed in a further underground space within the mastaba. A unique feature of the first dynasty tombs is that these rulers practiced human sacrifice in the form of having many servants killed and buried alongside the pharaoh to serve them in the afterlife. Djer, the third pharaoh of the first dynasty, had over 500 servants killed and buried within and around his tomb, but that seems to be a bit of a heavy outlier. Human sacrifice for post-mortem servitude ended after the first dynasty, and we're not entirely sure as to why. A prevailing theory is that maybe the pharaoh's servants started standing up for themselves, claiming they could live out their natural lives and then continue serving after dying. The second dynasty, despite happening later, is a bit less understood compared to the previous dynasty. There's much less archaeological evidence that can be dated to this time, meaning we have to rely on the ancient lists of kings that the Egyptians left behind. But even then, those lists are always taken with a grain of salt considering their inconsistencies with names and lengths of rule. Nonetheless, the Second Dynasty is usually said to have occurred between 2890 to 2686 BCE. Some Egyptologists make an argument that the unification of Upper and Lower Egypt didn't actually occur until the end of the Second Dynasty, as the name of the final pharaoh of this group, Khasekhemwy, could be interpreted as two powers arise. It's also possible that Upper and Lower Egypt once again broke apart during the Second Dynasty, but Khasekhemwy reunited them. It's also possible that the capital of Egypt was moved to the city of Memphis during this time, a position the city would retain until the 9th Dynasty, though a couple much later dynasties would bring the capital back to that city. The 3rd Dynasty marks the beginning of the Old Kingdom proper in Egyptian history. It was during the Old Kingdom that Egypt started developing into what we classically think of as ancient Egypt. The pharaoh became akin to a god and they started building pyramids. The first pharaoh of the 3rd Dynasty was a man named Djoser, and he was also the first Egyptian king to have a pyramid built. The Pyramid of Djoser represents a massive change to how pharaohs were buried, as well as being a massive innovation within Egyptian architecture. Technically, Djoser's pyramid is a mastaba. However, it's actually several mastaba stacked on top of each other, with each higher mastaba being smaller, creating a stepped pyramid. This is why his pyramid is also sometimes called the Stepped Pyramid of Djoser. In order to help facilitate this process, the usual rectangular shape was made more square. And yes, I know all squares are rectangles, you know what I mean though. Another interesting fact about this pyramid is that it was made of stone instead of mud brick, specifically limestone. This meant that the structure was much more permanent than the earlier mastabas of the 1st and 2nd dynasties, with many being mostly destroyed by various means over the millennia. A final fun fact about Djoser's pyramid is that it was possibly designed by his chancellor and high priest Imhotep. If that name sounds familiar to you, it's because a fictionalized version of him serves as the antagonist in both the 1932 Boris Karloff and 1999 Brendan Fraser movies The Mummy. Most of the remaining pharaohs of the 3rd Dynasty also had their tombs made in the form of a stepped pyramid, though they have mostly fallen to ruin compared to Djoser's. Then, sometime in the late 2600s BCE, Pharaoh Huni passed away. It's possible that he had no surviving children with his chief wife, the queen consort. Therefore, the line of succession passed on to the child of another wife, his son Sneferu. With his ascension, Sneferu became the first king of the 4th Dynasty, and the true age of the pyramids began. Before we can learn about the 4th Dynasty, we should talk about the ancient Egyptians' beliefs about the afterlife. After all, the pyramids were tombs and they were to help facilitate a pharaoh's ease into the perceived life after this one. Egyptian beliefs about the afterlife would almost certainly have developed and changed throughout the region's history, depending on who was in charge, what deities they chose to exalt to higher positions, and what area of Egypt someone actually lived in. Nowadays, our most popular connotations of the Egyptian afterlife come from the Book of the Dead, a series of texts that were placed in a person's tomb that contained spells and instructions on how a person's soul was to find its place in the afterlife. It details common ideas you might know, such as the weighing of a person's heart against a feather to judge whether they were a good person or not. Now, a couple things about the Book of the Dead. First, its name. Book of the Dead is the English translation of the German Totenbuch, which was given to the text by the German archaeologist Carl Richard Lepsius. The actual Egyptian name for these texts would be translated into Spells for Coming Forth by Day. That implies a very different connotation for Egyptians' beliefs on death, which I'll be getting into. Now, the second thing about the Book of the Dead is that it was written in the New Kingdom period, a bit over a millennium after the pyramids of Giza were built. Like I said, beliefs in the afterlife almost certainly would have changed over time. So, what did the pharaohs of the 4th Dynasty believe when they were building their pyramids? Well, there are at least a few concepts that existed across all periods of ancient Egypt that we can talk about. As part of the afterlife, a person's soul, which is not actually correct, but I'll get there soon enough, was united to live with the gods in a celestial realm. Okay, so if soul isn't the right word, what is? Well, that gets a bit complicated. According to the Egyptians, a person was not just a single body with a single soul, but a group of several factors, both corporeal and incorporeal, working together. The physical body itself was called the Khet, and it was viewed almost like a shell for the internal incorporeal aspects of a human life. There are two main aspects I'll be getting into here, but just know that there are more. First up is the Ba. Ba is usually translated into English as personality. It's essentially everything about a person that makes them unique. So your sense of humor, likes and dislikes would help make up your Ba. The Egyptians believed that when the Khet ceased to function, it was the Ba that would need to make the journey to the afterlife. The second incorporeal aspect we're going to talk about is the Ka. And I will say that after my research, I'm still not entirely sure what the Ka actually is. It is definitely part of what we in the modern age would refer to as a soul. However, it almost appears to be, at least to me, an on-off switch indicator for a human's life. When you're born a god, it depends on where you lived for who you believed, breathed Ka into your body, thereby making you alive. When your time is up, your Ka leaves your body and you die. Your Ka immediately goes to the afterlife. At least I'm pretty sure. But that's obviously not the end for a person. Like I said, the Ba is what is supposed to go to the afterlife, but it can't survive there on its own. It needs the Ka again so that a person can be alive in the afterlife. That is where different spells and esoteric knowledge come in, which were carved into the walls of a pharaoh's tomb and sarcophagus. These would help the Ba navigate the afterlife to be reunited with the person's Ka. And when the two come together, they form the Akh, which is usually translated as intellect, but actually means magically affected one. This is essentially a new life after death, just one in the celestial realm with the gods. Becoming an Akh was the chief outcome of the deceased. Therefore, tombs were not technically tombs in the idea of a place where you put a corpse. For the ancient Egyptians, tombs inscribed with the proper funerary rites and spells were something more akin to a vehicle, one that could ensure you become an Akh. So, why pyramids for these vehicles? Well, it comes back to the Ba. Your vehicle was an extension of yourself, as it technically operated as a home for your Ba until it figured out how to be reunited with your Ka. So, the Ba's home had to be a proper match for the Ba itself. And when you are the king of Egypt, clearly your Ba is pretty all-important. That is the reason for pyramids. Also, if you're wondering why I focused on pharaohs so much when talking about the afterlife, besides the fact that this episode is about pharaohs, it's because during the Old Kingdom period, it was just a held belief that pharaohs actually were the only people who could make it to the afterlife. Commoners weren't allowed in until the Middle Kingdom. So luckily, we all get that honor now, as long as you actually follow the proper rites. Pharaoh Snefru's life before he became the king of Egypt is essentially a complete mystery. I had called him a possible child of Pharaoh Huni, but even that's up for debate. We just know that Snefru ascended to the role of pharaoh after Huni. He reigned for somewhere between 24 and 48 years. We know this vague stretch thanks to a Middle Kingdom list of kings that lists Snefru as having ruled for 24 cattle counts. A cattle count was usually an annual event where the number of cattle owned by each citizen of Egypt were counted, and the number owned would correlate to the amount of taxes that citizen had to pay. I say usually an annual event because sometimes it could be a biannual event instead. Biannual here meaning every other year and not twice a year. Other records indicate that at least three of Sneferu's cattle counts were biannual, but it's highly unlikely that all 24 were. Modern Egyptologists suggest at least 30 years of rule due to the fact that, during his reign, Sneferu oversaw the construction of three separate pyramids. We'll be getting to those in a second. Sneferu's reign would see Egypt begin to develop outwards, towards and against its neighbors. One of the probably more peaceful relationships established during this time was with the people living in modern-day Lebanon. Through them, Egypt would obtain cedar trees. The wood from cedar trees would be used to build ships and construction equipment for the pyramids and temples. Outside of Lebanon, it would seem that Sneferu's foreign excursions were less than peaceful. He led military campaigns against modern-day Libya and the region of Nubia, which held land in the southern quarter of Egypt and the northern half of Sudan. In Libya, Sneferu may have captured as many as 11,000 prisoners and over 13,000 cattle. According to the Palermo Stone, an artifact named for its current home in Palermo, Italy, that details the rule of several pharaohs of the Old Kingdom, Sneferu also captured 7,000 slaves from Nubia. It's believed that Nubia's population was far less than that of Egypt, so 7,000 people would have represented a major portion of its citizens. So through trade and, unfortunately, brutal conquest, Sneferu was able to turn Egypt into an international powerhouse. With a new massive force of slave labor, Sneferu began to experiment with the idea of a pyramid. His first pyramid is the structure now known as the Meidum Pyramid, though some people will argue that its construction was possibly begun by his predecessor, Huni. The Meidum Pyramid, named for its location in the site of Meidum, was originally a stepped pyramid. However, actions were taken later to smooth some of the lower steps with limestone slabs, creating the more smooth-sided pyramids we're used to seeing. Possibly due to instabilities with the architecture, the top half of the pyramid had fallen apart, revealing a more stepped interior underneath. There are two other interesting architectural changes with the Meidum Pyramid compared to its predecessors. First, the actual burial chamber itself was within the pyramid rather than underneath it. Second, the entrance to the burial chamber of the pyramid was on the structure's western side, while previous burial chambers had doors facing the north. The northern doors were made to correlate to a star-centric form of worship. The western door was made to align with the sun, symbolizing a change in the Egyptian religion as worship of the solar deity Ra became more prevalent. Sneferu's second pyramid is believed to be what we now call the Bent Pyramid. The Bent Pyramid is the first true pyramid we have that still maintains its entire structure. True here meaning smooth edges and not stepped. However, as you can probably guess by the name, its appearance is a bit wonky. About halfway up the structure, the angle of the pyramid drastically changes into a more shallow angle, from 54 degrees to 43 degrees. It's believed that this change was decided mid-construction due to instabilities in the pyramid structure. Though it's technically not a perfect pyramid shape, its look still makes it one of the most iconic pyramids to date. Sneferu's third and final pyramid, as well as the sole surviving true pyramid in shape and form, is the so-called Red Pyramid. It is located at the archaeological site of Dahshur, alongside the Bent Pyramid. That's about 45 kilometers, a little under 30 miles, north of Meidum. The Red Pyramid gets its name due to the more red hue that the limestone has taken on over the years. It is the largest of Sneferu's construction projects, standing at 344 feet tall, about 105 meters. This also makes it the third largest pyramid in Egypt. Granted, it's barely a foot taller than the Bent Pyramid, but it is still taller. The Red Pyramid has the same 43-degree incline as the upper half of the Bent Pyramid. This makes it seem a bit more squat compared to the other pyramids of its caliber, but it shows that Sneferu and the pyramid architects learned from their previous mistakes. Though the Red Pyramid was his final pyramid, we're uncertain if that is the final resting place of Pharaoh Sneferu. In the 1950s, mummified remains were found within, which would seemingly point to that being the king's burial spot, though results on the corpse's identification have so far been inconclusive. However, some Egyptologists also believe that we have not truly uncovered all of the secrets of the Red Pyramid, and there may be a secret chamber we've yet to find, which would reveal the true final resting place of the first pharaoh of the 4th dynasty. Nevertheless, when Sneferu passed away, probably sometime in the early 26th century BCE, his son Khufu took over, and he would begin one of the most ambitious building projects throughout the entire course of human history. Before we talk about the pyramids of Giza, let's talk about how pyramids were actually built. Media over the past century or so has constantly depicted the pyramids as being built by oppressive slave labor under the grueling desert sun. But how truthful is that narrative? Well, it would depend on what time you lived in. Obviously, with Sneferu capturing thousands upon thousands of slaves, he used them in order to build the three pyramids we ascribe to his rule. This, however, doesn't mean that all pyramids were built using slave labor. That idea was passed down to us by the Greeks, whose earliest documents about how the pyramids were built weren't even written until 2,000 years after Sneferu was alive. In fact, we now have evidence that suggests pyramids were in fact built by paid citizens of Egypt. I'll get more into that in just a second. Unfortunately, we can't say that every pyramid built after the reign of Sneferu relied on paid citizens. We can only say for certain that the pyramids at the Giza Pyramid Complex were constructed this way. Also, any stories of the ancient Hebrews being used as slaves to build the pyramids are just that. Stories. There's no historical evidence that the people who would become the Jews were enslaved en masse in Egypt. And even if they were, it would have been long after the Egyptian pyramid craze died down. The Egyptian citizens who built the pyramids were almost certainly doing this as some form of tax system. Instead of giving the pharaoh money or livestock, you can instead choose to work on the pyramids. The exact number of people who worked on the Great Pyramid of Giza, the largest one built for King Khufu, will never be known for certain. Some people say that it had to be over 50,000 men, while others say that there couldn't have been over 30,000. What we generally believe, though, is that these workers were very well paid for their services, mostly in the form of bread and beer. Before we had better technology for filtering water, beer was actually a safer bet for your daily liquid diet than water, since the fermentation process would kill any bacteria. Also, entire villages were built near the Giza Plateau specifically for the citizens to live in during their stint as pyramid builders. As for how these laborers transported and built with insanely heavy limestone bricks? Well, that's a bit less certain. Any actual construction equipment for the pyramids has been mostly lost. The earliest descriptions of pyramid building by Greek historian Herodotus, the same guy who insisted the pyramids were built by slaves, made the suggestion for a series of levers, or perhaps one very sturdy portable lever, that could be used to lift the limestone blocks that weighed several tons. Though how a lever like that could ever lift the stones that weighed almost 80 tons is beyond me. And that system isn't even necessarily how they were built. Nowadays, the prevailing theory on pyramid building involves loading up large bricks of limestone, which would have been carved beforehand by a workforce that was almost certainly larger than the actual stackers, onto platforms that were either sleds going through sand or on cylindrical wheels. Surprisingly, several different ramp theories have also been proposed, ranging from one single large ramp that would be raised for each new layer to a series of ramps wrapping around the edges, continually being built up as each layer was finished. Unfortunately, we'll probably never know for certain how exactly the pyramids were built unless we uncover more first-hand accounts from that time. But in the present day, we know that it was a massive team effort of the Egyptian citizens who toiled for years on end just to build a single one of those structures. And not that I need to say this, I really hope, but it for sure wasn't aliens. It's finally time to talk about Pharaoh Khufu, also known by the Greek version of his name, in Greek Cheops and anglicized as Cheops. Khufu was likely the son of Sneferu and his queen consort Hetepheres. Well, we know that Hetepheres was almost certainly his mother, but her relationship to Sneferu is up to debate. But to avoid going down that rabbit hole, let's just go with the theory that the two were married and the parents of Khufu. Very little is known about his reign, including, like Sneferu, the length of which he ruled. Most estimates nowadays put his reign at slightly less than 30 years. What information we have would paint a picture somewhat similar to the rule of his father, just minus the mass enslavement of his neighbors. He no doubt continued trading with the people in Lebanon for cedar. He also maintained the practice of the previous rulers of mining for metals and minerals in the Sinai Peninsula, which is the northeastern corner of modern-day Egypt but was not actually under Egyptian control back then. Mines in Sinai would have granted the Egyptians access to both copper for tools and turquoise for jewelry and other ornamentation. Khufu may have possibly also instructed for the first crossing of the Red Sea by boat, at least probably by the Egyptians. The people of Sudan almost certainly were doing this earlier to trade with southern Arabia. This Egyptian effort would be due to the quarrying of minerals around the Sinai Peninsula that would be easier to carry by boat. In the region of Wadi al-Jarf, a region on the Gulf of Suez where it connects to the Red Sea, archaeologists have uncovered an entire port town that has given us a major glimpse into the daily life of people working on Khufu's pyramid. So let's jump over to talking about the Pyramid of Khufu, shall we? While his predecessor had made massive headways in Dahshur, the dried up limestone quarries and lack of space forced Khufu to look further afield. He eventually decided upon the Giza Plateau since it was spacious and would offer a wide view for the citizens to see his new pyramid. The structure itself is currently 454 feet tall, about 138.5 meters, though it originally stood taller until the top was broken off. It is the tallest pyramid in the world and is made of no less than 2 million blocks of limestone, with different exact numbers varying. In its heyday, the pyramid would have been covered by smooth white limestone. The cap itself was probably made of a different material, with some suggesting electrum, an alloy made of silver and gold. It's believed that it took somewhere around 20 years for the pyramid to be finished. An interesting aspect of the pyramid building process, which I alluded to earlier, comes from a personal diary archaeologists discovered at Wadi al-Jarf. The diary belonged to a man named Merer, who was in charge of a group of limestone miners. The diary is made of papyrus and is perhaps the oldest papyrus manuscript we've ever found. Now, technically, Merer never says he was mining limestone for the Great Pyramid of Giza, but based on the dating and names he uses, it makes it seem like that was his primary business at the time. According to his diary, it took Merer and his crew about 4 days to go from the quarry at Tura to the Giza Plateau. And though he never gives exact numbers, it's been theorized, based on his writings, that Merer and his workers transported about 200 limestone blocks, each weighing over 2 tons, a month. It's also in Merer's diary that we get the name the ancient Egyptians would have used for the pyramid, Akhet Khufu, the Horizon of Khufu. The burial chamber, where Khufu would have been laid to rest, is basically in the dead center of the structure, both vertically and horizontally. The sarcophagus of the pharaoh is made of granite. Based on the size and shape of the sarcophagus, it's been suggested that it was lowered into the pyramid while the structure was being built, instead of being brought in later. Now, it may sound a bit simple in structure, but the sarcophagus itself didn't need to be ornate. The pyramid itself represented Khufu's status as the pharaoh of Egypt, the representative of the power of the gods among the citizens of the nation. However, the massive scale to which Khufu constructed his final resting place would actually harm his image centuries later. When the Greeks and Romans decided to record their histories of Egypt, they insisted that Khufu was a tyrant, with his pyramid being a sign of his vanity. Unfortunately, we can't fully say whether these later historians were just pushing their cultural views onto the past or if there's any truth there. Most modern historians would agree on the former, but with how little primary sources exist from the 4th dynasty, it's possible we'll never know the true life of the man buried in the Great Pyramid of Giza. Khufu died sometime around 2566 BCE. He was succeeded by his son, Djedefre. Even less is known about him than we know about Khufu, but it's agreed that he probably ruled for about 10 years. He was also the first pharaoh to introduce the title Son of Ra to the various names employed by the kings of Egypt. However, unlike his father and the king who would reign after him, Djedefre chose not to build his pyramid at Giza. His pyramid, which is now in ruins, was built about 5 miles north of the plateau. Some recent archaeological research suggests that he may have commissioned the construction of the Sphinx at the Giza Pyramid Complex. However, traditionally, the Sphinx is attributed to Djedefre's successor. Djedefre was succeeded by his brother, or more likely half-brother, Khafre. As it goes in this story, his reign is a mystery, including the duration of it. We know he ruled for 13 cattle counts, so that means anywhere from 13 to 26 years. Based on the size of his pyramid, historians usually trend towards somewhere around 25 years long. So let's just get talking about his pyramid, yeah? The Pyramid of Khafre is the second tallest pyramid at the Giza complex and throughout Egypt, standing at 441 feet tall, making it 13 feet shorter than that of Khufu. Interestingly, the bottom outer casing of his pyramid was made of pink granite before transitioning to limestone further up. Also, the name given to his pyramid at the time of construction was Wer Khafre. Khafre is great. I personally like Horizon of Khufu more, but you gotta give props to Khafre for giving his pyramid such a self-serving name. While his pyramid is as equally impressive as his father's, the true mystery of Khafre's monuments is the Great Sphinx of Giza. We know so little about the Sphinx, down to the fact that, as I previously alluded to, we can't even say who decided to build it. There was a time when it was thought that the Sphinx was depicting the face of Khufu. We have almost no statues of Khufu remaining, and those that exist look close enough to those of his sons that the face of the Sphinx could belong to anyone in that family. That's why there's a possible theory that, even if Khafre or Djedefre commissioned the Sphinx to be built, they ordered that it be made with Khufu's face to honor their father. However, most Egyptologists will probably tell you that the Sphinx is depicting Khafre. But why a Sphinx? After all, the mythological creatures we call sphinxes, a creature with the head of a person and the body of a lion, weren't as much a part of Egyptian culture. They were much more popular among the Greeks. In fact, it was the Greeks who first started calling that statue a sphinx. We don't know how it was referred to when Khafre had it built, but at least by the New Kingdom pyramid, it was being called Horus of the Horizon, after the Egyptian god of kingship and the sky. But going along with the ideas of godly depictions, it's possible that the Sphinx was actually made as an offering to the goddess Sekhmet, a war goddess who, ironically, is usually depicted with a human body and lion head. Otherwise, it could have been a symbol of the god Amun-Ra, who was sometimes depicted with the body of a lion and the head of a goat. Or it could just be symbolic of Khufu or Khafre's power and regality. But let's move along, because we have one more pharaoh with a pyramid at Giza. There's a whole messy narrative about who succeeded the throne as king after Khafre. An ancient Greek historian wrote that a guy named Bikeres was the next king. Unfortunately, there's no evidence that this Bikeres even existed. Also, Bikeres is a Greek name, and we can't find any Egyptian names from that period that could have been the basis. So, I'm just going to throw that narrative aside to say that Khafre's successor was his son, Menkaure. Menkaure's story is essentially the same as the previous rulers I've talked about after Sneferu, meaning, yep, we don't know anything. His reign is believed to be somewhere around 20 years long. His is the third and smallest pyramid that was built at the Giza Plateau. Standing at 213 feet, it is significantly smaller than that of his father and grandfather. If Khafre also built the Sphinx, it would make sense why he might also settle for a smaller pyramid than his father. But Menkaure, besides several very well-preserved statues of him, has no other massive landmark to stake as his own. Well, there are three much smaller pyramids standing besides his, but it's believed that those were possibly built for his wives. During the rise of the Ayyubid Sultanate in the late 12th century, Sultan Al-Aziz Uthman, son of Saladin, a major figure in the Third Crusade, attempted to have the pyramids at Giza torn down due to his belief that they were blasphemous. Because Menkaure's pyramid was the smallest, the Sultan ordered for it to be demolished first. However, after 8 months of grueling work, the soldiers had barely made a dent in the structure, so the Sultan ordered them to stop. That is why, to this day, there is a massive hole on the northern face of Menkaure's tomb. A theory about why Menkaure's pyramid is so much smaller has to do with a possible shift in the landscape of the Egyptians' religion and the status of the pharaoh. As I said before, Khufu and Khafre's pyramids were massive endeavors to show off the power the kings of Egypt wielded. However, things in Egypt might have been changing even as early as the reign of Khufu that saw the importance of the pharaoh alongside the gods change. Sometime during the 4th dynasty, the cult of the sun god Ra started rapidly gaining power. This can be seen mainly with the reign of Djedefre. Why did he have his pyramid built further away from Khufu's? While it could have been that the new pharaoh was looking to claim his own piece of land, it's believed that he had his pyramid built further north so that it was closer to the city we called Heliopolis, the main site of the cult of Ra. We can also see the rising importance of Ra with the pharaoh's names beginning with the sons of Khufu. The Re at the end of Khafre, Djedefre, and Menkaure are all just the ancient Egyptian reading of the name Ra. For whatever reason, perhaps a desire to adhere to the old ways, or maybe things weren't fully shifted over yet, Khafre decided to go big with his pyramid and have it built next to his father's. With Menkaure, we still get a pyramid at Giza, but one much smaller in scale. And a possible theory is because Menkaure didn't need to show off his might as a human king, even if the title Son of Ra was among the titles he took. His pyramid did not exist for himself, but as a stepping stone for the king to join with the sun god in the afterlife. This trend would continue as pyramids grew smaller, if even being built at all. Menkaure's successor, Shepseskaf, who was either his brother or son, was buried in a single-tiered mastaba rather than a pyramid. During the 5th dynasty, pyramids were built even smaller. By the end of the 6th dynasty, pyramid building was abandoned altogether. And thus, the golden age of Egyptian pyramids came to an end. Not with a glorious monument rising to the heavens, but with a structure that now stands in ruins. Pyramids would make their return to Egypt during the 12th dynasty, which began in the early 20th century BCE. While these pyramids once again attempted to go a little bigger with their goals, the structures were made out of mud brick rather than stone. This means that many of them are no longer standing. Eventually, pyramids would fall out of fashion once again as Egyptian pharaohs shifted gears to more elaborate mortuary temples. Eventually, even those were abandoned to make way for smaller, albeit still well-decorated, tombs within the Valley of the Kings near Thebes. This is the home to the tomb of King Tutankhamun. However, another boom of pyramid building would once more come about in the general region, just not in Egypt. Just south of Egypt was the kingdom of Kush in present-day Sudan. For almost a millennium, from the 7th century BCE to the 3rd century CE, Kushite royalty was buried in Egyptian-style pyramids. Ironically enough, considering how entrenched in the zeitgeist of Egypt we consider pyramids to be, Sudan contains more than double the amount of pyramids, and that's just those we've found. Granted, the Sudanese pyramids are much smaller than those in Egypt, with most being between 20 and 98 feet tall, between 6 and 30 meters. However, it just goes to show that, even after they died out further north, the influence of the pyramids was felt for centuries afterwards. Heck, we're even heavily influenced by them today. Just check out that really weird Bass Pro Shop pyramid in Memphis, Tennessee. Yes, Memphis is named after Memphis, Egypt. Or the Luxor Casino in Las Vegas. And that's only naming a couple pyramids in the modern day. They are magnificent structures, and hopefully I've demystified pyramids a bit today for those of you who didn't know much about them beforehand, which I know is probably funny to hear considering how many times this episode I had to say, hey, we just don't know enough about this. The Pyramid of Khufu does deserve to be one of the wonders of the ancient world, and though I'd like to have been able to see some of the others, I think it rightfully deserves to be the oldest and only one still standing to this day. But for now, that's it for this week's episode of Royally Screwed. I hope you enjoyed the journey. Be sure to subscribe to the show and tell a friend all about it. So, a few episodes back, I covered Rani Lakshmibai, a figure from the Indian Revolution of 1857. In that episode, I called out a historian who claimed she was the Joan of Arc of India, instead saying she reminded me much more of someone else. Well, it's time I fulfilled the promise of talking about that figure. Next time, we're talking about Boudicca, a Celtic queen of Britain who sought to take on the forces of Rome after they took everything from her. I hope you'll join me then for another topsy-turvy look into history's most interesting rulers.